Lise Borken for the SCC Historical Society in Washington, D.C., at the offices of Judge Borken. Judge, will you tell us about your background, including your education, before you came to the SEC?
I was born in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, in 1932. I went to the through the public school system, and after graduating from high school, I attended Penn State University for 4 years. I then, upon graduation with an accounting degree, I practiced for about almost 2 years for a CPA firm called Library and Ross Brothers and Montgomery, which is presently, I guess, the PricewaterhouseCoopers. I then took my CPA exam, passed it, and later became a certified public accountant. In the ensuing years, I decided that I would go back to school, and in 1954, I entered Yale Law School. I graduated in 1957. Upon my graduation from Yale Law School, I became a member of both the Pennsylvania and Delaware Bar. I clerked for a federal district court judge in Wilmington, Delaware, Judge Caleb M. Wright. I then, for a short period of time, clerked for another judge there, Judge Paul Leahy. Upon finishing my three-year clerkship, I came to Washington and became associated with a Washington law firm then known as Haley, Wallenberg, and Bader. I was there for 1 year in practice. I then left to go to the SEC in 1961 to become part of the special study of securities markets.
Tell us a little bit about your family, who I understand lived in Philadelphia.
Right. I was one of four children. There were three brothers and a sister. My father was in Philadelphia politics for many years as a Republican. He held the position of assistant district attorney for 20-some years. He then became a judge of the state common pleas court and was a judge for maybe 25 to 30 years. My mother was a housewife raising the children. And that really was my background. I'm the only lawyer in the family that took, who followed in my father's footsteps.
What drove you to go to the SEC for a job?
Well, I very much enjoy coming out of law school. I very much enjoy the clerkship. It was almost like a halfway house, and that's what I used to teach my own law clerks. Between the academy, the theoretical, and the practice. And you got a little bit of both in the clerkship. I enjoyed it immensely, and that's why I stayed 3 years. I then went into the private practice, and it was a rude awakening. There was very little theoretical. It was all very practical. I was the low person on the totem pole in this small law firm, and I didn't feel that I was doing what I thought a lawyer should be doing. I wanted a challenge, and I wanted to get into government. I explored the possibility of going as into the Internal Revenue Service in view of my CPA background and my law degree. However, the problem with going to government to the IRS was that I had to go to a city like Cleveland or Boston or any city other than the city where you grew up. So I couldn't get a job in Philadelphia. And I was recently married at that time, and we were both families in Philadelphia, and we didn't want to go too far from our support people. And so I decided that I would have to look for other opportunities. And this occurred when I learned that the SEC was recruiting for this monumental study that had been ordered by Congress. This was as a result of the scandals at the time in Wall Street, and therefore Congress said that there should be a study of the securities markets. I don't think there's ever been anything like it since that study. It was a fantastic study. And so I went to the SEC. They hired me, and I had a wonderful, I guess it was 2 years on the staff.
Who hired you?
My recollection there, I think I was interviewed by two people. One was Gene Rotberg and the other was Freddie Moss, who then brought me in to see Ralph Saul. And I don't think that Milk Cohen was on the staff at that time. And they hired me. I forget how much time it took them to make up their mind, but it was not too long. And Art Fleischer might have had a hand in it, my recollection. He was the chairman.
Were you assigned to any particular part of the special study?
Yeah, the assignment I received was the self-regulatory organizations, particularly the NASD. My boss on that was Marty Moskowitz, and the two of us did the study, I think, essentially the NASD.
Had you had any previous exposure to the securities laws during your clerkship or your private practice?
Yes, I did. Well, obviously, the fact that I was that my background was in financial, and I took a lot of accounting courses in order to qualify to take my CPA. So I knew it from that end of it. Also, during my clerkship, we had a very important case involving at that time the Wellington Fund, and that case put into issue who owned the name Wellington. What was happening was that Wellington, the management company, had as its flagship the Wellington Fund, which was a diversified balanced fund. They wanted to bring out another fund which would be all equities and call it the Wellington Equity Fund. Shareholders of the Balance Fund brought a lawsuit in Delaware claiming that the name Wellington Fund in the mutual fund area, in the fund itself area, was owned by the Wellington Fund itself, and that therefore the management company did not have the right to bring out another fund and name it Wellington. It was a very interesting case. The argument came down as to whether the court was going to buy the management company's theory that bringing out a fund was like a product, and they used the example, it was like a box of Kleenex, and that they could bring out as many different companies as they wanted, and since they were really the driving force. The judge took the position that so long as the fund itself, the fund with the shareholders, was using the corporate form, they're entitled to all of the protections of the corporate form, which included the ownership of the name, and therefore ruled against the management company and said that the balance fund occupied the entire field of mutual funds, and that they were entitled to the exclusive use of the name Wellington. And I think that was a very important case because it did establish the concept that a fund was different than its managers, and that had a separate existence, and it was entitled to all the protections of the law.
Did the SEC submit any amicus or other views in connection with
the case? I do not recall. On my recollection, they probably did not.
Getting back now to the special study, can you just give us some of your recollections as to your field that you were inquiring into, and more generally as to the work of the special study that you're familiar with?
Well, yeah, we were examining the whole concept of self-regulation. And you will notice from the study, and I have not reviewed in a long time, that it was in its embryonic stage, and there were a lot of problems to self-regulation. We came out with numerous recommendations. The one that sort of bothered me more than anything else was the concept that an errant member would be tried by a peer group, and that it would be done in the afternoon and not very much would happen. And I came out with a concept called cocktail hour justice. And I think from the study that a lot of changes came about, and including later on that there was added to the people trying the cases, the hearing personnel, that when you had the exchange, the NESD adopted the concept of having one of the three members of the three-member panel as a professional hearing officer, and that there were a number of different recommendations to shore up the NESD, and all to the good, but it was a fairly elaborate report. The whole special study was a fantastic experience. It brought together a number of people that were just superb individuals, and they later on went on to become leaders in the securities area.
Can you tell us something about the working schedule and the impact it might have had upon your family?
Yeah, at that time, my wife, I was married, I had a daughter who was born while I was in law school, and I guess in 61 or 2, my first son was born, and we worked hard, and my wife, now of almost 50 years, understood that, and like all other good wives, she put up with these long hours, but she understood that to get ahead, you had to work hard.
After you left the special study, you joined what part of the commission?
Well, I was always enamored with trial law, and I also loved what the SEC did. And this was a natural blend of financial matters because of my CPA background, and the fact of trying to get into some kind of a litigation field. And so what happened was when the special study disbanded because of the recommendations, there was an explosion at the SEC in which they hired a number of additional people. And so they looked to the people at the in the study and evaluated us and gave some of us offers. I was given an offer. I wanted to work with a fellow named Pollack, who ran the enforcement program and was even at that time a legend. Everybody saying that's the fellow you had to work with. And so that's where I went to work in the division. I guess it was called Trading and Exchanges at that time. And it was a very small unit, extremely small. And Mr. Pollack determined that what he was going to do was to set up three branches. Up to that time, very little enforcement work was done at the home office. All of it was done in the regional offices. But it was determined that we had to have some kind of a capacity in the home office to be able to take care of the cases that the commission itself wanted to prioritize, and so that we didn't have to depend on the regional offices. And so they set up these three branches, and I believe I was made a branch chief right off the bat, to run one of these branches, which we had a very small group, maybe five lawyers at that time.
All right.
Later on, I think. Later on, we were given the services of an accountant.
Okay. That was in the year 1963, roughly.
Yes, it would have been in 63, I guess, would have been the year, right?
And do you recall the early cases you worked on?
Oh, gee. There were a number of cases that we had. The first case that we had. We had a number of cases. I think one case was a case called Fabricant Securities, and I guess that was just a boiler room. And I guess Irv indicated there was a boiler room, and that he didn't understand how a boiler room could stay in business for any more than for as long as this company stayed in business. And I remember that we went and we put them out of business. The big case that I had right then and there was a case involving a group of promoters who had brought out three different companies. One was General Development. The other was, General Development. The other was Seven Arts Production. And the third was International. Not International Controls, but forget the name of it. It was a third company, which I'll think of in a minute. And the common ingredient in these three companies was a group of promoters headed by a fellow named Lou Chesler and Carol Rosenblum and Morris Max Schwabel. They were the ones who ran these companies, and it was clear that although these were companies of some substance, that there was a lot of activity in the stock which caused the price to go up, and a lot of money was being made on the buying and selling of the stock. So we then went after these promoters and these companies. We, I guess, successfully brought cases. The ringleader was a fellow named Lou Chesler, and we finally were able to, I believe, to be able to take action against him. They were very interesting cases. What impressed me most was they had great lawyers representing them. People who were honorable and decent, and people who wanted to do the right thing. And they had Louis Loss, as I recall, David Pocross. I don't remember who were some of the local people, but these were good people. But we were able to prevail and to prevail in these cases.
You recall who worked with you, if anyone?
Yeah, my recollection was that Erwin Borowski, who I had met in a Fabricant case, he worked for the state of New York. He was the Elliott Spitzer before Elliott Spitzer, and he was tough, and he did a good job for New York, the New York Attorney General, and they had brought a case against Fabricant at the same time we were bringing a case, and the. And I said after the case was over, I liked the way he did business, and I asked him whether he wanted to come and work in Washington. He said he would, and he, in effect, came down to work with us. Steve Paradise worked with us. Ira Pierce worked. So we had a core group down there. Yeagerman later would help us, but he was a person who was all to his own.
What was the next important step in your career?
Well, the next case we did, at that point, Tom Ray was a very important person. He was my boss between Pollock, was a fellow named Ray. Ray was the associate director, who was probably one of the finest administrative attorneys I've ever been with. He really had the system working, and I learned a lot from him about how to manage. He was a great manager. And what happened was that, of course, we started to expand, and I think from branch chief I became an assistant director. When became assistant director, we then got involved in the famous international controls case involving a fellow named Robert Vesco. Also involved in that case was Bernie Kornfield. And we started to pursue them, and that became almost a career project. As a matter of fact, Robert Vesco is still on the loose. He fled to Cuba, and he's still not responding to the calls from the Department of Justice to come back and be prosecuted in New York City.
Do you recall any significant programs that were being developed in your work at this period of time?
We obviously were. It was a new venture, the business of a home office enforcement group, and we had to define ourselves and how to differentiate ourselves from the work of the regional offices. And so we tried to define what cases we in the home office would handle, what cases would be handled in the regional office. And we came up with not a very precise division, but really what it said would be if there was a matter that was multi-region, then the home office would take it. If it was part of an enforcement program that has been developed at the home office, we would take it, such as insider trading, certain kinds of other kinds of problem areas that are coming to our attention. The thing that was so amazing about the enforcement program is that we all had the philosophy, and I'm sure Irv and I discussed it, in which what we were always attempting to do was to put ourselves out of business. Of course, we realized that would never happen. Well, how did we do it? What we said was that we would use enforcement to disclose an impediment in the system. And then what we would do is we would try to get some kind of a rule or regulation to fix that problem on a long-term basis. Now, I don't know if that philosophy still is in existence at the SEC, but it was through that policy that a good number of the important investor protection rules were developed. For example, we found in takeover cases that you had situations where there were blind takeovers. We came in and remedied that by recommending to the people that they must identify who the person is. We also found in situations that companies would take in making a tender offer, would prefer certain shareholders over others. In other words, they would buy away from the tender offer. Again, we saw that as a problem and recommended and helped develop the regulation or the rule that requires everybody to get the same price in the tender offer. And I'm sure there are other tender offer rules. We're also responsible for, as we went up the ladder, with other rule. I'll give you another rule that we were responsible for. People don't understand it. But I think 15C211 was a rule that came right out of our shop. And that rule, it was based upon the premise that that a trader had to know the security that the trader was trading in. Because what you would have are over-the-counter securities were selling for as high as $100 a share, and nobody knew anything about the company, and some of them were shell promotions. And so we made it that that traders and securities had to know the merchandise, and that's what 15C211. But all these came out of the enforcement work and came out of on the philosophy that you had to have good regulations and that you couldn't do it all by enforcement, and that the enforcement would expose what regulations were necessary.
So you were interacting with the regulatory side of the division in accomplishing these goals?
Yeah, and this was obviously, that this was right from the top. I think this is something that Mr. Pollack would espouse. This would be something we discussed. And it was something that made a lot of sense. The beauty of working in that time is that this fellow was the greatest boss that anybody could ever have, because he, first of all, philosophically, we were in sync. Secondly, that he allowed his people that worked under him to develop and to go as far as they could. He was strictly a person who insisted that the division be a meritocracy. But as I would go up the ladder, and we started to develop another strategy that we had. What always was something that intrigued me was this concept of trying to, not only the concept of getting a regulatory fix, but also the concept of getting a strategy for what kind of strategies could you use to make life easier, to help in policing the markets. We knew we didn't have enough people. We knew we were always strapped for personnel. And so we had to get a strategy that would help us stretch our enforcement dollar as far as it would go. And in this regard, we developed the so-called access strategy, which, to my delight, has now become one of the underpinnings of Sarbanes-Oxley. Of course, they call it the gatekeeper strategy. But the access strategy was developed on the concept that for a promotion to be effective required the assistance or help of a professional. You had to have access to the marketplace, otherwise the promotion would fail. And access to the marketplace was kept by a number of different professionals. You had to have a good lawyer, an accountant, a broker-dealer, maybe a banker. And the theory was that we didn't have the resources to police every crooked promoter. There were too many out there. But we could narrow down that to a very small group if you said what we'll do is we'll look to the access givers and go against them when they go and participate in an illicit activity. And there we realized that if someone needs an accountant, in those days there was what's known as the Big Eight accounting firms, only eight of them, who commanded maybe 95% of the public company business. And so it became much easier to look at eight than to look at thousands of promoters. Similarly, in the broker-dealer area, you could narrow down the number of broker-dealers giving access to the marketplace. In the legal area, again, you could be narrowing down the focus. And so what we did is, while we didn't bring, hordes of cases, what we did do is, when we brought a case, we would grade out the participants, and we would see where the access givers were, and if they participated in the fraud, we would then bring actions against the access givers on the theory that they very much wanted to maintain their license to do business, and that therefore they would make sure in the future that they would not do it again. And so you're going to see at that point the strategy which dictated that we would bring in cases against accounting firms, we would bring cases against lawyer firms, we would bring cases against major broker-dealer firms. It's almost a repeat of what's happening today. And in those cases that we brought, for example, during the period when I was the director, we brought, I think, 18 cases against major accounting firms. Now, in response to this access theory, when the access givers learned what was happening, they became defensive and they took certain steps. And what did they do? Well, in the broker-dealer community, for example, they set up the concept of compliance, and each of the major broker-dealers went out and got a compliance director. Now, the compliance director's role and responsibilities was to set up processes and procedures in their own firms to prevent their firms from violating the law. So by developing this strategy, we were then able to increase the budget of the SEC many-fold, because in effect you had almost an enforcement lawyer in every one of these major brokerage firms, which were in effect an adjunct to our own people out there working. And it worked fairly well, not perfect. But remember, this was done without any increase in our budget. And we would then hold them accountable. And the strategy was very, very important. And I am pleased to see that it has been validated by Sarbanes-Oxley, even though it has been given another name. But there's no question that the firms themselves in the broker-dealer field have got to be the first responders and have to have an in-place compliance program.
In dealing with the general corporate community, did you have similar strategies with respect to the remedies that you sought in your cases that you worked on?
Well, of course, came up with tremendous ideas in the question of use of equitable remedies. The whole disgorgement that now is part of the Sarbanes-Oxley law was really started in these cases we would bring, and we would seek it as part of ancillary relief in the injunctive actions that we would bring. We did a lot of things that were, remember, the one good thing about not having laws that were so definitive as they are now was that we had a lot of room to be able to experiment with. For example, and not only a lot of room to experiment, but we also had a culture at the SEC that would permit people to do things that would be unbelievable in this day and age. For example, I like to give as an example the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. And again, this is not in any way to extol my own abilities or anything like that, but that whole law started on the basis of my going home in the evening in the early 70s and watching the Watergate hearings, and watching at the end of the hearings where certain companies would testify as to making payments to political payments to Nixon. And what bothered me by watching that was I didn't understand how these companies were making these payments, even though they knew they were illegal, because it was always been illegal for many, many years for companies to make direct campaign contributions to a political person running for political office, as opposed to doing through PACs and other and soft money. So after watching these hearings, I remember coming in one day and asking Mr. Bob Ryan of the staff to go out and find out from Gulf Oil how did Gulf Oil make these payments and how do they book an illegal payment. And he came back within a day and had the whole case, which was that they had set up two phony subsidiaries called Bahamian X and Bahamian Y. They put $5 million into each one of them, took the money back to the offices of a fellow named Dorsey, put it in his safe, and that's where the payments came from. And the reason they did it that way is they capitalized the amount of this slush fund because they didn't want to violate the Internal Revenue Laws, which would have happened if they had expensed those payments. And so when we got on that area, we started then to look case upon case upon case, and before we knew it, we had developed a horrendous situation where we found that out of those slush funds that were being used to give money to political parties, we went into them and we found that those monies were also being used for other nefarious activities, such as bribing officials in countries to get business. We found that they were being used to bribe even domestic officials. We found that they were being used to give undisclosed perks to officers and directors. And so, before we knew what we had, brought about 65 cases against major corporations. Now, at that time, there was a wonderful senator, Senator Proxmire, who was the chair of the Banking Committee. Senator Proxmire very much appreciated what the SEC had done and called me one day to find out what kind of legislation was necessary. And I advised the senator that all that was really necessary was that they have a books and records provision, because not one of these companies booked these bribes and these other illegal monies payments or sensitive payments correctly. And I said, there is no provision that requires a company to keep accurate books and records. He bought that. He got a law passed, and as fast as I can ever imagine, that would require companies to keep accurate books and records. Sandy Burton at the time said, we need an internal controls provision. That's in the books and records, which really predates Sarbanes-Oxley. And people got to understand there is a provision that requires companies to have proper internal controls. And then Proxmire himself put in the anti-bribery provision. So that became the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, which is a very important piece of legislation, a very important piece in the field of corporate governance. It was the really first, one of the first entries of the SEC into the field of corporate governance. And that was just absolutely tremendous the way that worked. But it shows you how, in a very offhand way, the SEC were able to make such progress. As a side note, it's interesting that after we brought so many cases, the commission got a little bit upset. And I remember Alan Levinson, who was a partner in this thing and helped tremendously, and he was the division director of corporation finance at that time, and I were attending a conference in San Antonio, Texas. I think it was a one of these state-sponsored conferences, North American Securities Administrators Conference. We got a call from the then chairman, Ray Garrett. We got a call from Ray Garrett to come back to Washington immediately, and Ray said to us, look, we got to get a means for fixing this problem. We can't be suing every company. And it was at that point where Alan and I, and Irv, I guess, was on the commission at that time, but we came up with the so-called volunteer program, which again, to the delight of Alan and me, which we discussed before he recently passed away, validated another one of our programs, and namely this, we allowed companies to come in and to make disclosures concerning their sensitive payments with an undertaking that they would do an investigation, with an undertaking that they would make disclosure in their filings. And this so-called volunteer program went extremely well. And my recollection is over 650 companies made voluntary disclosures of their making of sensitive payments.
Now, with the increase in the number of cases you were bringing, did you find it necessary to reorganize the way in which cases were tried as distinguished from just investigated?
Yeah, we had to do a number of things. Again, the beauty of the system was that with Pollack running it, we were very creative. And of course, I followed in his footsteps and learned a lot from him. And we had to do certain things. We had to fix certain problems. One was the problem that you alluded to, which is what happened was that we had found that we were starting to try more cases. And the way we used to do it was that a staff attorney who developed a case would then try it. Well, the problem was that staff attorney did not have a whole lot of trial experience. And he found himself or herself up against lawyers of the likes of Edward Bennett Williams, Milton Gould, the real fantastic trial lawyers, and we were getting beat. Not because we didn't have the good facts, but because these lawyers were so competent and so highly regarded by the courts. And so we had to develop, or I came up with the idea that we had to develop a trial unit. We had to bring in experienced trial lawyers. I discussed it with Pollack, and Irv thought, how are we going to get these experienced trial lawyers? You know, it's going to be difficult. But he said, let's do it. Let's see what we can do. And of course, we did it. And we would bring in what we did. We started out. I remember we had one fellow on our staff who was an investigator but tried a couple cases. And his name was Bob LaPrade. And we got Bob through the unit. And then we worked from there. Started out by happened was that we started applying people. Then we got Rick Yeager, who had tried our case. He was a U.S. assistant U.S. attorney who had tried a criminal case. He liked it. He decided to come east. We then picked up Ben Greenspoon, who was a neighbor of mine, who was leaving the profession. He was a great trial lawyer, didn't know anything about securities. He came on. Ted Sondy came down from the general counsel's office. We then had Romano and Rosano came. I got a call one day from Goldstein, who was the U.S. attorney. Frank Goldstein was U.S. attorney in New Jersey, who was leaving office, and he asked whether I could take on two of his great assistants, and they were Romano and Rosano. That they turned out to be extremely capable lawyers, and we developed a unit that was, I believe, second to none in government. And I would start getting the feedback from the lawyers on the other side, who would tell me that we really were putting great people into the courtroom, and that has survived until this day. There was a lot of consternation among the staff who thought that they would be hurt by not being able to go into court. But the way we solved that is we made them second chairs in these cases. And we did another thing with the regional offices. The way we had originally set it up when we were in an embryonic stage is the recommendations from the regional office would come into our office, and they would be assigned to the various attorneys, enforcement attorneys, and then they'd get massaged and go to the commission. The problem was that they would take a back seat to the work that these attorneys were doing. And what we then did, Irv and I, we decided that what we would do is to try to set up a separate unit. And we got people that were interested, didn't want to do travel, and that they made appearances before the commission, and that they then serviced the regional offices on a full-time basis. That worked extremely well, and we developed the George Fitzsimmons, Fred Franklin's, Bob McConaughey's of the of the staff who worked. So we developed this group that did the regional office servicing. The regional offices, we started to work. This was a very, very important part of our relationship with the regions. They saw that they were getting fantastic service, and it worked well. There was a phone names. One of the things that we tried to do was also to fit the person to the job. Not everybody was a rocket scientist, and therefore we had people that could do jobs well. For example, George Fitzsimmons, who we picked out of the industry, who what he did was examine when he came for a job at the SEC. We found out his background was examining deeds and real estate papers, and when we went into hiring, I remember a guy named Fonts, I guess it was, in the personal office that said, "Why do you want to hire this guy? It doesn't look like there's much to him." And I said, "We're not hiring him to go out and try cases. We're going to hire him to sit at the desk and examine papers from the region." We finally convinced him that that was the right way to do it, and this fellow, Fitzsimmons, turned out to be just absolutely fantastic. He later became the secretary of the commission. Similarly with Irv and Jim Foster, he worked out so well that he got promoted to be the head of personnel. And so that's what happened to all our good people that we had put in. They were taken over by other people. But we had a group of people, and I think I've got to spend a minute or two to tell you how great these people were, and they've now proven it by doing so well in the private sector. There was Art Matthews, who was a fantastic lawyer, and he did extremely well. He was great at the commission. He was great in private practice. Chick Marcoux was another fantastic. Larry Williams. So we had a core group when I took over, and these people were super. Later on, we had another core group, and those included such people as Wally Timoney, Ted Levine, Ed Herlihy, Dave Doherty. This was another fantastic group. And then coming behind them was Hartigan and Gary Lynch and Bill McLucas. And you talk about a bench strength. We had such a strong and long bench that it was there was nothing like it in government. These were just, of course, I mentioned Erwin Borowski before, but the bench was absolutely fantastic. Rick Sharp, a Sandy Weiner, a Rich Morvilla. These are all now leaders of the bar out there and do it extremely well. We work closely with our New York counterparts, as you know, where the Marvin Jacobs and the Bill Morans the Kevin Duffys, the Steve Hammerman. So we had a very, very strong, strong group of people. The thing that I think happened, though, is that at the end, you left, Pollock, I think, left to go on the commission in the 70s, and it's 70, about 74, I guess, and then left the commission maybe in 80. And at that point, having lost him, I decided that I didn't know what I was going to be doing, but we had a new chairman. Chairman Shad came on. I was debating what I wanted to do at that time, although I was going to stay, but then I got a call from Casey to go over to the to become general counsel of the CIA. Casey, what people didn't understand was a fantastic chairman of the SEC. He was only there a short time, but he taught so many of us. He taught us that the most important thing that he taught me, how important it was to make a decision. And his point was that not making a decision is a decision, but it's one you don't have control over. But he was decisive, he wanted to make decisions, he was a risk taker. I remember in many instances when we would be often opposed by general counsel, who was always a sort of with always, and I don't want to say it in a negative sort of way, but in as much a positive way as I can, but they were always making sure we weren't pushing the laws to the point where we get hurt. And so therefore they were always throwing roadblocks on what we wanted to do. And there were many times we would go up before the Casey Commission in which we would recommend one thing, the general counsel would say no. And Casey would almost invariably side with us. Usually we had Alan Levinson on our side. But he was willing to take that risk. And it really, in many instances, it paid off. For example, in one case that we brought where one of it was a steel company. And we found that Posner was the head of that steel company. We found out they were dipping into the employees' pension funds. And without anybody telling or anybody complaining, we went and sued the steel company, whether I think it was Phoenix Steel Company, I forget the name of it. But anyway, and we got the money back to the workers of the steel company.
Are there any other commissions?
I just want to mention. And what happened then was that Casey was the chairman. I remember I got a call one day from Casey saying, "You got me in trouble." I said, "How'd I get you in trouble?" He says, "I just got a visit from I.W. Abel, who was the head of the steelworkers." He says that Abel told him, he says, he doesn't know what the game of this Nixon, I guess it was the Nixon administration was. He didn't know what they're trying to do. He says, and trying to curry favor with the workers. But if that was their goal, he didn't care because he was very pleased that we had brought a case to protect his steel workers. And Casey, who was obviously being facetious with me, was in effect congratulating me on a job well done, and he said that's the right thing to do, we did the right thing. So that's the kind of thing you were going to ask.
Are there any other commissioners or chairmen that stand out in your mind?
Well, we had wonderful, as you know, where, of course, your Pollock was the leading person as far as I'm concerned. But we had Al Summer, we had Frank Wheat, we had John Evans, we had Ray Garrett, we had Phil Loomis, Dick Smith, that these were all. Matty Cohen, of course, was a little bit, Matty Cohen was just, Barney Woodside. I mean, this was, again, an all-star. Even Senator Freer was a lovely person out of the state of Delaware. And this was great commission stuff, really you can't beat these people. I'm sure I must have missed Jim Needham. Judge Budge was another person who lived up to the office and made sure that we were doing what we're supposed to do. But these were to go to those commission meetings when we had a Pollock and a Summer and a Weed and a Loomis and a Garrett. It was like getting a course in the finest law school in the country on securities laws to see that law going around, law being discussed by these experts.
You became director of the Enforcement Division in 72.
That would have been the time.
74. In 74.
In 74 I became director.
The division was formed in 72.
Yeah, I became a director in 74. Yeah, I was deputy director in 74.
Deputy director. And then you left in 1981. And you became associate director of the Division of Trading and Exchanges or Trading and Markets, as it may have been known earlier, in 1968.
I think that's right.
Yeah. Right. I'd like to make some closing observations overall on the commission and the present situation.
The problem with the commission over the years is the fact that it has deviated from its core purpose. And that's why one of the reasons we're having the problems that we're having. The core purpose of protecting investors has got to be paramount. But when Pollock left in 80 and I left in 81, the commission then went on a laissez-faire type of basis. Put out releases saying we wouldn't sue lawyers anymore and injunctive courts and did a lot of other things. And of course, the message that went out to the investment community was, okay, you know, we can now start up and do things in any way we want to. And then, of course, the new scandal comes and it gets tightened, and then it gets loosened and tightened. And I think if there's anything we learned from the current scandal, and I hope now we can now rededicate, or the SEC can rededicate itself to realizing that it's got to continue with a strong enforcement and regulatory program. Once it now eases up again, it's going to, I submit, cause the same problems that have happened before. This is not, SEC should not be a political institution. It should not be an institution that changes with the political winds. It's got to be an institution that is there almost like some of the other banking institutions and say, okay, this is what we're for, the soundness of the system, and we must preserve that. And unless it rededicates itself to that basic philosophy, these things will occur again. I mean, when we go back, when we went back to our years with the concept of the gatekeeper and strongly going there, and then that the next commission comes in and says, wait a second, gatekeepers, I mean, corporations or companies don't violate the law, individuals will go after suing the individuals. It was, the ball game was over. And that's, I think, in large measure why you're having some of the things. Because if the SEC were calling the game tough and close, it's almost like in a football game. As soon as you stop calling the penalties, then you're going to see all kinds of things happening. And I think that's what the SEC's got to do. It's got to maintain a very strict enforcement stance. I think if that happens, I don't think you're going to have these periods where the system gets shocked with these tremendous revelations of dishonesty.
Thank you very much, Judge Ford.
All right, so we did it.